Her bit was done. She was way out of her depth now. Reg 1 and 2 were waiting with her. The other two patrol members were giving covering fire from the olive grove side of the fence as we moved towards them, letting off double taps at anything that moved. They needed to conserve ammo. We didn't have Hollywood mags. Reg 1 was shouting commands. Move back to the FRV. Move back. He had a SATCOM out. Its miniature transmission dish pointed skyward, telling the world that we were in the shit. I didn't know who he was talking to, but it certainly made me feel better. Every other man carried a poncho stretcher, a big sheet of green nylon with loop handles, as part of his kit. Reg 2 laid his on the ground as I removed Glenn's belt kit and Bergen and put it on my back. So much for travelling light. As we rolled him onto the stretcher, he was still conscious, but if he hadn't already, he'd soon go into shock. It was then that I heard an ominous slurping noise in time with his breathing. He had a sucking wound to his chest. Air was being sucked inside his chest cavity instead of going through his mouth. It was going to need sorting out quickly because otherwise the fucker was history. But there wasn't enough time to do it here. That way we'd all die. We'd have to wait until we reached the FRV. Reg 2 heard the noise too. Grasping Glenn's hand, he placed it on his chest. Plug it up, mate. He wasn't that out of it. He understood what he needed to do. With the chest wound, we couldn't give him morphine. He was going to have to take the pain. Two of us got hold of him, one either side of the stretcher, and started to hobble along with him as quickly as we could. Sarah following at my heels. I didn't look at what was going on behind us, but I heard the rate of covering fire from Reg 1 and 2 step up as we moved off. We hit the tree line, Glenn's moans distorted by the jolting as we ran. We got further into the grove and only then moved to the right, under cover. He was still conscious and breathing noisily as we laid him on his back. The light from the target area was just enough to see my hands moving as they worked on him. There was no need to worry about clearing his airway, but his hand had fallen from his chest. I put my hand over the wound to form a seal. Hopefully, with his chest now airtight, normal breathing would return. I could see the anguish in his eyes. His throat spluttered as he coughed and fought the pain. What's it like? What's it like? Oh, shit. He screwed up his face even more as Reg 2 moved him. It was a good sign. He could still feel it. His senses hadn't given way yet. Reg 2 finished checking him. No exit wound. First, you've got to plug the leaks. Then you have to put in fluid to replace what's been lost. I watched as Reg 2 grabbed the field dressings from Glenn's belt kit and ripped them open. You always use the casualty's own dressings. You might need yours later. The packaging was Israeli, but they looked the same as ours, like big, fat sanitary towels with a bandage attached. Their job in any language is to block up wounds and stop bleeding by the application of direct pressure. A round from an AK had also ripped through the muscle mass on his thigh, like a butcher's knife slicing open a side of beef. He was losing blood fast. Reg 2 started to cavity pack the wound. The downside of Glenn still breathing was that we couldn't shut him up. Over and over he groaned. What's it like? What's it like? I looked down at him. He was covered in sweat and the dust had caked onto his face. Shut the fuck up, I said. It's nothing. We'll fix it. You should never let a casualty see you looking concerned. Sarah was several paces behind me, watching the route we had just taken, weapon out. I half whispered, half shouted, Sarah, come here. She moved towards me. I said, put the heel of your hand over this hole when I take mine off, okay? He was losing consciousness. Close to his ear, I said, it's okay. You can speak to me now. There was no response. Oi, come on, speak to me, you fucker. I pulled on his sideburns. Nothing. I pulled up the left sleeve of his coveralls to expose the 6-inch band of tubi grip on his forearm. Underneath that was the catheter, already inserted in a vein before we left Delhi. You'd have to be mad not to. A bit of anticoagulant in the catheter to stop the blood from clotting, and it will last for a good 24 hours. You are a bit sore afterwards, but it will save your life. It's hard to get a vein up to insert a catheter once you've lost fluid, especially under fire and in darkness. Reg too had nearly finished packing the thigh wound. It would have been no good just piling bandages on top, because the muscle underneath was still going to bleed. You have to really pack the cavity, keeping direct pressure on the wound, and that, in turn, will stop the bleeding. That done, he now needed fluid. Glenn's breathing was very rapid and shallow, which wasn't a good sign. I felt the pulse on his neck. Same problem there. His heart was working overtime to circulate what fluid was left around his body. Shots were now being fired at us from about 100 meters away, but all my attention was focused on Glenn. Reg 2 shouted at Sarah. "Watch him, and tell us if his breathing starts to slow down. Got it?" She nodded, and started to take notice. I pulled the plasma expander from his belt kit, a clear plastic half-liter container shaped like a washing-up liquid bottle. I ripped it out of its Israeli plastic wrapper and threw that on the ground. I bit off the little cap that kept the neck of the bottle sterile. Fuck hygiene. Infections could be sorted out in hospital. Let's keep him alive so he can get to one first. By now, I also had his IV set out of its protective plastic coating and was biting off the cap to the spearhead connector and jabbing it into the self-sealing neck of the bottle. I undid the screw clamp, took off the end cap and watched as the fluid ran through the line. I heard it splash onto Glenn's face. He didn't react. Bad sign. Rolling the screw clamp on to stop the flow, I wasn't concerned about air bubbles in the line. A small amount doesn't matter, certainly not in these circumstances. Let's just get the fluid in. There was more gunfire from the target area, too close for comfort. And for the first time since we'd been in the trees, our blokes fired back. The Syrians had found us. Reg 1 was still in command. He was down at the tree line waiting for us to sort Glenn out. "How much longer up there?" Reg 2 called back. 2 minutes, mate. 2 minutes. I need your fluids." As he jumped up with his weapon to collect the kit, I unscrewed the end cap of the catheter and screwed the IV set into it. Sarah was still plugging the hole. I could hear her breathing quickly in my ear as she leant over Glenn. "Nick, listen to me. Let's leave them to it. Let's go." She was right, of course. The two of us would stand a far better chance on our own. I ignored her and carried on working on Glenn, gently squeezing the bottle to get the fluid into him. She whispered a bit more urgently. "Come on. We need to go now, Nick. Remember, this is what they get paid for. And you are paid to protect me." Glenn had to be dangerously low on fluids, but he was still conscious, just. "Sarah, pass me your fluid, quick." She used her free hand to pull the Bergen straps off her back to get to it. The first bottle was now empty. I turned off the IV with the screw clamp. Sarah had her fluid in her hand. I said, "Open it." I heard her ripping the plastic with her teeth as I pulled off the empty bottle. She handed it over. The sound of gunfire was still very much in the background. Reg 2 came back, packs of fluid pushed down the front of his jumpsuit, panting as he collapsed on the floor next to us. I jabbed the new bottle into the set and opened up the screw cap. Reg 2 was studying Glenn. All of a sudden he shouted, "Fuck, fuck, fuck," and leaned over, grabbing Sarah's hand and lifting it. There was a sound like a rush of air escaping from the valve of a car tire, and a fine geyser of blood sprayed in all directions. The round must have pierced his lung, and as he breathed in, the oxygen was escaping from the lung and going into the chest cavity. The pressure had built up so much in his chest that his lungs hadn't been able to expand, and his heart couldn't function properly. That was why Sarah had to watch and listen, because the pressure on the heart and lungs would make him breathe much slower than he needed. Reg, too, went ballistic, still gripping her arm.
Fucking bitch! Fuck you! Do it right! What are you trying to do? Kill him!
She said nothing, as the air gush subsided. Then, very calmly, she reminded him who was boss.
Let go of my arm at once, and get on with your job.
Reg, too, placed Sarah's hand back over the wound. Glenn was just about conscious, but still losing blood internally. Reg, too, got right up to his face.
Show you can hear me, mate. Show me.
There was no reply.
We're gonna move you, mate. Not long now before we're out of here, okay? Okay.
All he got in reply was a low moan. At least there was a reply. Reg, too, had to turn him to check the leg dressing. Blood started to run out of the hole and down Sarah's fingers. She looked at me, pissed off, as another fluid set was being connected. She wanted out of here. The others were rolling into the FRB, out of breath and confused about what had happened.
Is everyone here? Reg One counted.
He came over to us and looked at Glenn.
Is he ready to go?
Reg Two, still looking at the casualty, said,
I think we're just about to find out.
Using one of the large safety pins that came with the field dressings, he pinned Glenn's tongue to his bottom lip. Glenn was out of it. He couldn't feel a thing. The danger was that, in a state of unconsciousness, his tongue would roll back and block his airway. I turned to Sarah as they sorted their shit out for the next phase and whispered in her ear.
Our best chance now is with these boys. If you don't want to come, that's fine. But you leave the Bergen, I'll take it back.
The look on her face said she knew she had no choice. She wasn't going to leave. She couldn't do it without me. Reg, too, placed one of the ripped plastic coverings over the wound to seal it better and instructed Sarah.
Get your hand back on that.
He and another Reg picked up the casualty. Reg, too, kept the bottle high for the fluid to run freely by holding the hanging loop in his mouth. It wasn't a tactical move to the wagons. It was a case of getting out of there as fast as we could, bearing in mind the weight of the casualty and his comfort. I didn't know what was going on behind me, back at the target area. And I didn't really care. We reached the vehicles about 30 minutes later. I grabbed Sarah and took her to one side. There was no point getting involved in what these blokes were doing. We were just passengers. That wasn't good enough for Sarah.
Come on, she hissed. Why aren't we moving yet?
I pointed at the rear Previa. They'd got the back door open and were pulling the seats down to create a flat space for Glenn. Looking beyond them, I noticed that the town was still dark. I was right. The industrial units must have had emergency power. The driver of our vehicle retrieved the key, opened the door and motioned us inside. Another of the team got in the front. He leaned back towards us. As soon as they're ready, we're going to move to the ERV. Emergency rendezvous. We were sitting in darkness, the driver with his NVGs on. There was tension in the air. We needed to get going. If not, it wouldn't just be Glenn who'd be in the shit. I didn't talk to Sarah. I didn't even look at her. At last, the other vehicle started to move off, slowly, and ours manoeuvred in front of it and took the lead. It wasn't long before we hit the metalled road. Behind us, headlights came on, and Sarah took this as her cue to get out her laptop. A few seconds later, she was going shit or bust on the keyboard. The screen glowed in the darkness, lighting up her sweaty, dirty face. My eyes moved to the maps, diagrams and Arabic script in front of her, none of which meant anything to me. And then, down at her well-manicured fingers, which were tapping away furiously on the keys and smearing them with Glenn's blood. We drove like men possessed for 20 minutes. Then, after an NVG drive into the desert with IR filters on the wagon's lights for another 10, we stopped.
Apart from the engine gently ticking over and the noise of Sarah's fingers hitting the keys and her mumbling the Arab script she was reading, there was silence. A beeping noise came from the laptop. She muttered, "Fuck it." Her battery was running out. There were shouts from the other Previa. Somebody was working hard on Glenn, yelling at him, trying to get a response. Silence was obviously out of the question now. It's hard to be quiet when you're fighting to keep a man alive. The driver looked at his watch after about 5 minutes. He opened the door and shouted, "Lights!" Then started to flash the wagon's IR light between dipped and full beam as he hit the Firefly and stuck it out of the window. Even as this was being said, I started to hear a throbbing noise in the distance, and less than a minute later, the sky was filled with the steady, ponderous beat of an incoming Chinook. The noise became deafening, and stones clattered against the windscreen and bodywork as the Previa rocked under the downwash from the rotor blades. The pilots wouldn't be able to see the vehicles or the ground now, due to all the sand and crap his rotors were throwing up. A few seconds later, a figure loomed out of the dust storm, bent double, his flying suit whipping around him. He flashed a red light at us, and the driver shouted, "That's it, let's go!" Our vehicle edged forwards. We drove for several yards into the maelstrom of wind and dust before things started to calm down. Red and white Sialume sticks glowed around the open ramp, and the interior was bathed in red light. Three loadies wearing shoulder holsters, body armor, and helmets with the visors down were beckoning to us, urgently with a Sialume stick in each hand, as if we needed any encouragement. Our Previa bumped up the ramp as if we were driving onto a cross-channel ferry, and one of the loadies signaled us to a stop. The other vehicle lurched in behind us, and as soon as it had cleared the ramp, I could feel the aircraft start to lift off its hydraulic suspension. Moments later, we were in a hover. We swayed to the left and right as the pilot sorted his shit out and the loadies lashed down the tires with chains. Hertz were going to be one very pissed-off rental company. We were no more than 60 feet off the ground when I felt the nose of the Chinook dip as we started to move off and turn to the right. Chaos erupted inside the aircraft. The Regs spilled from their vehicles, shouting at the loadies, "White light! Give us white light!" Somebody hit the switch and all of a sudden it was like standing on a floodlit football pitch. The inside of the other wagon looked like a scene out of ER. Glenn was still on his back, but they'd ripped open the front of his coveralls to expose the chest wound. Blood was everywhere, even over the windows. Reg, too, ran over to a loadie who was still at the heli ramp, checking it had closed up correctly. He shouted as loudly as he could against the side of the guy's helmet and pointed to the rear wagon. "Trauma pack! Get the trauma pack!" The loadie took one look at the bloodied windows, disconnected the intercom lead from his helmet, and sprinted towards the front of the heli. Everybody had a job to do. Mine was simply to get out of the way. I left Sarah sitting in the back of our Previa sorting out her laptop and moved to the front of the Chinook. I knew where the flasks and food would be stowed and, if nothing else, I could be the tea lady. As I moved to the front of the aircraft, I met the loadie on his way back with a trauma pack, a black nylon bag the size of a small suitcase. I stepped to one side and watched him open the bag as he ran, bouncing off the front wagon and airframe as he momentarily lost his balance. At that moment, Sarah jumped out between us with a laptop and power lead in her hands. She was shouting at him, "Power! I need power!" He went to push her aside, yelling, "Get out of the fucking way!" "No!" She shook her head angrily and put a hand on him. "Power!" He shouted something back at her. I didn't know what because he was now facing away from me, pointing towards the front of the aircraft. She moved quickly past me towards the cockpit, so bound up with her own obsession that she didn't even see me. I continued on, heading for the bulkhead behind the cockpit. I picked up one of the aluminium flasks, which was held in place by elastic cargo netting, and started to untwist the cup. Coffee, not tea. and it had never smelled so good. As I turned and started to walk down towards the rear previa, flask in hand, I could hear them, even above the noise of the heli, shouting with frustration. Two drips were being held up, and a circle of sweaty, dusty, and blood-stained faces was working on him. As I got closer, I could see they were rigging him up in shock trousers. They're like thick, ski salopettes, which come up past your hips and are pumped up to apply pressure to the lower limbs, stemming blood loss by restricting the supply and so keeping more blood to rev up the major organs. It was a delicate procedure, because too much pressure could kill him. Reg, too, looked as if he was on the case big time. He was holding Glenn's jaw open, breathing into his mouth with the safety pin still in place. I was close enough to see his chest rise. Someone had his hand over the chest wound, ready to depressurize. Once Reg, too, had finished inflating his lungs a few times, he shouted, "Go!" Another was astride him, both arms outstretched and open hands on top of each other on his chest. "One, two, three." There was obviously no pulse, and Glenn wasn't breathing. He was technically dead. They were filling him up with oxygen by breathing into his mouth, then pumping his heart for him, whilst simultaneously trying to make sure that no more of his fluid escaped from any of the holes he had in him. Glenn's chest was just a mess of blood-matted hair. The team were going to be too busy to drink coffee, so with nothing useful to do, I pulled up my left sleeve and peeled back the tubey grip. Ripping off the surgical tape holding the catheter in place, I carefully pulled it out, pressing down on the puncture wound with a finger until it clotted. I looked around for Sarah. She was in a world of her own, sitting near where the coffee flasks were stowed. She'd found the power point and an adapter that fed a 2-pin plug, and her fingers were tapping frantically at the keyboard once more. I looked back at Glenn. There was still lots of shouting and hollering going on in there. I just hoped that whatever was on that computer was worth it. I looked out of one of the small round windows and saw lights on the coastline. We had a Bowser inside the Chinook, feeding extra fuel. It looked like this was a direct flight, and that we were on for tea and toast in Cyprus later that morning. I took a sip of coffee. As we crossed the coast and headed out to sea, I stared out of the window, my mind starting to focus on the deep sound of the two big rotors throbbing above us. I was cut out of the daze by the despairing shout. "Fuck it! Fuck it!" I looked up in time to see the bloke who'd been astride Glenn's chest climbing down slowly onto the deck, his body language telling me everything I needed to know. He swung his boot and kicked the vehicle hard, denting the door. I turned my head and stared back out of the window. We were flying low and fast across the water. There wasn't a light to be seen. My ear was hurting. I reached into my pocket and checked around for the lobe. I sat there toying with it, thinking how strange it was. Just a small lump of gristle. Hopefully they'd stitch it on all right. But what did it matter how bad I looked? I was alive. I stood up and went over to Sarah. It was my job to look after her, and that included keeping her informed of what was going on. She was still immersed in her laptop. I said, "Sarah, he's dead." She carried on tapping keys. She didn't even look up to see me offering her a flask top of coffee. I kicked her feet. "Sarah, Glenn is dead." She finally turned her eyes and said, "Oh, okay." Then looked straight back down and carried on with her work. I looked at her hands. Glenn's blood had now dried hard on them, and she didn't give a shit. If it hadn't been for her fucking about and not telling us that the job wasn't as straightforward as we were first told, maybe he'd still be here, a big fucking grin on his face. Maybe Reg 2 was right. Maybe she had been trying to kill Glenn at the FRV. She knew that I would have been the patrol and gone with her, if he wasn't still in with a chance. The team was sitting against the wagon, opening flasks and lighting up, leaving Glenn exactly as he was. We'd all been doing what we got paid to do. Shit happens. This wasn't going to change their lives, and I certainly wasn't going to let it change mine. As Sarah carried on hitting her computer keys, I drank coffee and watched the line of the Cypress coast appear, trying to work out what the fuck I was doing here. April 1998. Chapter 1. Friday the 24th of April, 1998.
3 gallons a day, that's your lot, the bosun barked. But 2 gallons have to go to the cook, so there's 1 gallon. I'll tell ye again, just 1 gallon, left over for drinking, washing, and anything else ye need it for. Anyone caught taking more will be flogged. So will gamblers, cheats, and malingerers. We don't like malingerers in Her Majesty's Navy.
We were lined up on either side of the deck, listening to the bosun gobbing off about our water ration. I was trying not to catch Josh's eye. I knew I'd burst into a fit of laughter, which Kelly wouldn't find amusing. There were about 20 of us, new crew, mostly kids, all dressed in the standard issue 16th century sailor's kit, a Hessian jerkin and shirt, with trousers that stopped about a foot short of the trainers we'd been instructed to bring with us. We were aboard the Golden Hind, a full-sized reconstruction of the ship in which Sir Francis Drake circumnavigated the globe between 1577 and 1580. This version, too, had sailed round the world, and film companies had used it as a location so often it had had more makeovers than Joan Collins. And now it was in permanent dock, serving, as Kelly called it in her very American way, as an edutainment attraction. She was standing to my right, very excited about her birthday treat, even if it was a few days late. She was now 9, going on 24. "See? I told you this would be good," I beamed. She didn't reply but kept her eyes fixed on the bosun. He was dressed the same as us, but was allowed to wear a hat, on account of all the extra responsibility, I supposed.
"Ye slimy lot! I've been hand-picked for a voyage with Sir Francis Drake. Aboard this, the finest ship in the fleet, the Golden Hind."
His eyes fixed on those of each child as he passed them on the other line. He reminded me of my very first drill sergeant when I was a boy soldier. I looked over at Josh and his gang, who were on the receiving end of his tirade. Joshua G. D'Souza was 38-ish, 5 feet 6 inches, and, thanks to being into weights, about 14 stones of muscle. Even his head looked like a bicep. He was 99% bald, and a razor blade and moisturizer had taken care of the other 1%. His round, gold-rimmed glasses made him look somehow more menacing than intellectual. Josh was half black, half Puerto Rican, though he'd been born in Dakota. I couldn't really work that one out, but nor could I be bothered to ask. Joining up as a teenager, he'd done a few years in the 82nd Airborne and then Special Forces. In his late 20s, he'd joined the US Treasury Department as a member of their Secret Service, in time working on the Vice Presidential Protection Team in Washington. He lived near Kelly's dad's place, and he and Kev had met, not through work, but because their kids had gone to the same school. Josh had history standing next to him, working hard at understanding the bosun's accent. They were on their last leg of a whistle-stop tour of Europe during their Easter vacation. Kelly and I had collected them off the Paris Eurostar just the day before. They were going to spend a few days seeing the sights with us before heading back to DC, and Kelly was really hyper. I was pleased about that. It was the first time she'd seen them since what happened, as we called it,
over a year ago. All things considered, she was pretty well at the moment, and getting on with her life. The bosun had turned back and was moving up our line.
"Ye will be learning gun drills. Ye will be learning how to set sail and repel boarders. But best of all, ye'll be hunting for treasure and singing sailor shanties."
The crew was encouraged to respond with their best sailor-type cries. All of a sudden, competition for the loudest noise came from the siren of a tourist boat passing on the river, and the bark of its tannoy as the first sailing of the day did London Bridge. I glanced down at Kelly. She was quivering with excitement. I was enjoying myself too, but I felt just a bit weird standing there in fancy dress in full public view, aboard a ship docked on the south side of London Bridge. At this time of the morning, there were still office workers walking along the narrow, cobblestoned road that paralleled the Thames, dodging the delivery vans and taxis on their way to work. The trains that had got them this far were slowly trundling along the elevated tracks about 200 metres away, making their way towards the river. The pub next to the ship, the old Thameside Inn, was one of those places that supposedly dates from Shakespeare's day, but which, in fact, was built maybe 10 years earlier, on one of the converted wharves that line the river. The office crowd, plastic cups and cigarettes in hand, were making the most of the morning sun on the terrace overlooking the water, having picked up their late breakfast from the coffee shop. I was hauled back to the 16th century. The bosun had stopped and was glaring theatrically at Kelly.
"Are you a malingerer?"
"No, sir. No, sir."
She pushed herself into my side a bit more for protection. She was still a bit anxious about strangers, especially adult men. The bosun grinned.
"Well, seeing as you're a special crew, and I know you're going to work hard, I'm going to let you have your rations. You'll be getting some special sailor's nuggets and coke."
He spun round, his hands in the air.
"What do you say?"
The kids went bonkers.
"Aye, aye, sir."
"That's not good enough," he bellowed. "What do you say?"
"Aye, aye, sir."
The kids were shepherded by the bosun and the rest of the permanent crew towards the tables of food.
"Small sailors first," he ordered. "The tall sailors who brought you here can wait their turn."
Kelly ran over to Josh's three. Two girls, Dakota and Kimberly, aged 11 and 9, and a boy, Tice, who was 8. Their skin was lighter than Josh's. Their mother was white. But they looked just like their dad, except they still had all their hair, which was a good thing, I thought. Josh and I turned and looked out over the deck towards the Thames. Josh waved back at some tourists who were waving from the boat, either at us or at the coffee morning still going strong to our left.
"How is she coping?" he asked.
"Getting better, mate.
But the shrink says it will take time. It's affected her schooling big time. She's way behind. The last lot of grades were shit. She's an intelligent girl, but she's like a big bucket with holes. All the information's going in, but it just drips out again."
"You think about what she's been through, man. For sure it's going to take some time."
We turned to see all 4 of the kids throwing chicken nuggets down their necks. It was a strange choice for breakfast, but then again, I liked choc ice and chips first thing in the morning when I was a kid. The elder daughter wasn't getting on with Tice today, and Josh had to do a dad thing.
"Hey, Kimberly, chill. Let Tice have his coke. Now."
Kimberly didn't look too happy, but obeyed. Josh turned back towards the river, took off his gold-rimmed glasses, and gave them a wipe.
"She looks happy enough. That's a good sign."
"It's the best she's been for ages. She's slightly nervous around adults, but with her friends she's okay. It means so much for her to see your lot. Besides, It gives her a rest from me. I couldn't bring myself to say that I found it wonderful to see him as well. I hoped he knew anyway. We both looked out over the river with not a lot to say. He broke the silence.
How's the job? Are you on permanent cadre yet?
I shook my head. I don't think it will ever happen. They know I was involved in a lot more of the Washington stuff than I let on. It pissed me off because I needed a regular income these days. I had the money I'd rescued from last year's gangfuck, but that wouldn't last forever. I grinned. Maybe I could turn to crime. Couldn't be worse than the shit I do now. He frowned, not sure if I was being serious or not, and tilted his head in the direction of the huddle of small sailors, as if to remind me of my responsibilities. He put his specs back on and focused on a black guy in an old, shiny blue tracksuit who had set up shop at the corner of the pub, selling the big issue and chatting up the women walking past. "It's okay for you," I said. "We don't have a training wing where I can go and put my feet up and still get paid." I thought Josh was going to give me a lecture, so I put my hands up. "Okay, I surrender. I will sort my shit out. One day." In a way, I had sorted myself. A bit. With the money I'd diverted from the Washington job, £300,000, once the dollars were converted, I'd bought myself a house up on the Norfolk coast in the middle of nowhere. The village had a co-op on the corner, and that was about it. A traffic jam was when the three fishing boats came into the harbour, and their vans arrived at the same time to take the catch away. Otherwise, the busiest it got was when the postman rang his bell as he was going around the corner. I didn't know anyone, they didn't know me. If anything, they all had me down as an international drug dealer or some weirdo. I kept myself to myself, and that suited everybody just fine. I'd bought a motorbike too. At last I had the Ducati I'd always promised myself, and I even had a garage to put it in. But what was left, about £150,000, wasn't enough to retire on, so I still had to work. And I only knew one trade. Maybe that was why Josh and I got on. He was much the same as me, running his life like a conjurer, trying to keep all the plates spinning on top of their poles. His plates weren't spinning so well at the moment. Now that Jerry had gone, one income wasn't enough, and he'd had to put the house up for sale. Josh had had a fucker of a year. First, his wife had got into yoga and all that mind-body-spirit stuff. Then she'd ended up going to Canada to hug trees, or, more precisely, to hug the yoga teacher. Josh and the kids were shattered. Something had to give. He could no longer travel away from home with the vice presidential crew, so he became one of the training team out in Laurel, Maryland. It was a very grand-sounding outfit. Special Operations Training Section. But a shit job for a man who was used to being in the thick of things. Then, 2 months after his wife left him, his friends, Kev, Marsha, and their other child, Ada, were hosed down. And he found he was an executor of the will, along with some dickhead Brit he'd never heard of called Nick Stone. Between us, we looked after Kelly's trust fund, and we'd been having some problems selling the family home. When it came down to it, who was going to buy a house where a whole family had been butchered? The property company was trying to pull a sleazy deal so it could get the land back. The insurance companies had been trying to give Kelly a lump sum instead of making regular payments, because it was cheaper for them. The only people getting any money were the lawyers. There was something about it all that reminded me of my divorce. I turned to him. "It is good to see you, mate." He looked back and smiled.
"Same here, mate."
His piss-taking accent sounded more Australian than English. Maybe they got neighbours in his part of Virginia too. There was really nothing more to be said. I liked Josh, and we had a fuck of a lot in common, but it wasn't as if we were going to be sharing toothbrushes or anything like that. I'd decided after Ewan turned me over to bin any idea of friendship with anyone else ever again, and to restrict myself to acquaintances. But this did feel different. "Talking of shit," I said, "how's the quilt shaping up? The kid sounded really ecstatic about it last night." His eyes looked up at the sky.
"Fuck, man. It's been a nightmare. 2 months of hoo-ha, and the kid's getting so high they might as well be on drugs."
I had to laugh. I'd been following the build-up to this from Josh over the phone, but no one was going to stop him honking about it a bit more now.
"I've been to meetings, meetings about meetings, sewing classes, discussion groups, you name it. That's been my life for the last 2 fucking months.
There was going to be a summit between the Israelis and Palestinians in Washington, D.C. Clinton was out to look the big-time statesman, brokering the peace deal, and somebody had come up with a bright idea of making the world's biggest peace quilt to commemorate the occasion. Kids from all over had been sewing like crazy in preparation for the world's biggest photo opportunity on the White House lawn.
Josh said, "I mean, do you have any idea how many stitches it takes to sew on just one fucking little shape?"
"Don't worry about it, mate," I said. "They'll turn it into a TV commercial for Coke, and then you'll all be rich." The bosun wanted us.
"Oi, you two! Come down and get your rations, or ye'll swing from the yard arm." "Aye, aye, sir." "I can't hear you. What did you say?"
Josh got into 80-second airborne mode, snapped to attention and screamed,
"Sir! Aye, aye, sir!"
The old boy flogging the big issue started to cheer and clap, though I wasn't too sure whether the bosun liked the competition. Josh collected his food and sat down amongst the kids, trying to pinch some of their breakfast. I got my ration of authentic Elizabethan nuggets, donuts, and pirate cola. A train from London Bridge Station rattled along the elevated railway line behind us, the bells of Southwark Cathedral just 50 meters away fired off a salvo, telling us it was 10:30 a.m. And here I was, wondering for the millionth time how I'd landed myself with all this. Josh told me he'd always loved the idea of being with the kids, but had never realized the stress of looking after them all the time until his wife left. Me? I loved it when I was with Kelly, but hated the idea of it. The responsibility filled me with dread. When it came to the world of emotions, I was a beginner. My birthday girl was holding court, telling Josh's kids about her boarding school.
"I got a 20-pence fine because I didn't wear my slippers to the shower room last week."
She loved the idea of being the same as the other girls. The fact that she had been fined meant she was one of the crowd. "Yes, and who has to pay the fine?" I said. She laughed.
"My manager."
Her school had been fantastic about everything, even though they knew only the bare bones of what had happened. I agreed with Josh that it was the best thing to do, taking her right away from the US and an environment that would bring back memories and screw her up even more. She never brought up the subject of what had happened the day her parents and sister died, but she had no problem talking about them if things came up in daily life to remind us of them. Only once had I made a direct reference and she'd just said,
"Nick, that was a long time ago."
She began telling everyone about the week's plans.
"Nick couldn't see me on my birthday and had to leave me with Granny and Granddad the day before. But this week, we're going to see the bloody tower."
"What?"
Josh's mouth dropped open. He might be ex-airborne at work, but within earshot of his kids, not even the mildest cuss would pass his lips. "She means the Tower of London," I said. "There's a place called the Bloody Tower. It's where the crown jewels are kept, I think. Something like that. History had never been my strong point. Kelly's face lit up at the thought of seeing all those jewels. As a child, I had never known that sort of joy. My mother and stepfather never took me anywhere. All they ever gave me was promises. When I was about 8, HMS Belfast docked by Tower Bridge and became a museum. All the kids on the estate went, but not me. All I got for weeks was IOUs. At last I was told I was going with my Auntie Pauline. I spent hours trailing around the local shops behind her, asking when we were going.
"In a minute, son. Not long now."
The bitch was lying. Just like my parents. The whole thing had been a ploy to get me off their hands while they went out on the piss. After that, I didn't even bother to ask. Fuck 'em. I had another 8 years before I could leave home. I'd treat it like a waiting room.
"Dan, we're going to have a sleepover at the place where all the mummies are. There's a museum where you can spend the..."
She was interrupted by the bosun, who'd maybe guessed that the tall sailors needed a rest.
"It's time for some seafaring tales, while ye have your feed. So listen in, all ye crew, small and tall."
It was while we were sitting there listening to the sea tales, and I was digging a chicken nugget into my red sauce, that I felt my pager go off. I liked the fact that people needed me to do things they couldn't do themselves, but I always kept it on vibrate because I hated the noise it made. It always spelled trouble. Like an alarm clock that wakes you on a morning you're dreading. I took it out of its little carrying case, which was attached to the draw cord of my trousers, and checked the screen. It was displaying only a phone number. I was aware that Josh was looking at me. He knew exactly what it was. The other kids were too busy listening to stories of doom and gloom on the high seas to notice, but Kelly never missed a trick. She shot me a concerned glance, which I ignored. Pager networks cover a larger area than mobile phones, which was why the intelligence service used them. I preferred them anyway, because it gave me time to adjust mentally before someone bollocked me. Or even worse, gave me the job from hell. I'd only had the pager for about 6 months. I wasn't too sure if it was a promotion to be given one, or if it meant I was considered a sad fuck and always available. Locked away like a guard dog until needed. Then, once done, given a bone and sent back into the kennel. Josh raised an eyebrow.
"Dramas?"
I shrugged. "Dunno. I'm going to have to phone. Can you hold the fort?" He nodded. "See you in a few." The stories were still going on, and the rest of the crew were producing tubs of ice cream for the spellbound kids. I slipped away and went down the stairs to one of the lower decks, where we were going to be sleeping that night. Mattresses were spread out on the floor, and we'd had to bring our own fluffy sleeping bags, just like 16th-century sailors did. Ho-ho. I rummaged in my hold-all for some small change and went upstairs and tried to sneak off the boat without Kelly seeing me. I should have known better. She must have been watching me like a hawk. As I looked round and saw her, I put my hand up and mouthed, "Be back in a minute," pointing at the pub. She looked puzzled, and more than a bit anxious. Josh was still with them, nodding and grimacing and generally joining in with the tales of seafaring derring-do. The cathedral bell rang out to tell me it was now 11 o'clock. I found a payphone in the pub hallway. The old Thameside Inn had its first customers of the day, traders from the fruit market drinking pints, rubbing shoulders with the city dealers and their bottled beer. As I stood with my finger in my ear trying to listen for the dialing code, I found myself looking at racks of tourist flyers. Rows and rows of the things telling me how great the Tower of London was. All of them seeming to point the finger at the scurvy mutineer who might be jumping ship. I pushed a couple of coins into the slot and dialed the number, putting my finger back into my other ear to cut out Oasis on the jukebox. After just one ring, a very crisp, efficient female voice said,
"Hello?
It's Nick, returning the page.
Where are you?"
She knew exactly where I was. Every call to the firm is logged on a digital display. They put as much effort into spying on each other as they do against the enemy. It was pointless tapping in 141 before the number and saying, "I'm in Glasgow and can't get back." Because whatever I did, the display would still tell her I was at a payphone in Southwark. I said, "London."
"Please wait."
She pressed the cut-out button. 2 minutes later, she came back.
"You need to be at Gatwick at 3:30 this afternoon."
My heart sank, but I already knew I was going to be there.
"How long for?"
Not that it mattered much. I was already a couple of jumps ahead, thinking about how I was going to make excuses to a recently turned 9-year-old. She said,
"I don't have that information."
Once she'd finished with the details of the RV, I put the phone down, expecting a refund of my unused coin, but I got nothing. The phone box in the pub was one of those private ones where you can charge whatever you want. For £1, I got all of 60 seconds. I walked back, making my way around the crowd outside which had moved with the sun towards the ship. I was racking my brains thinking of what I was going to say. Not to Josh, that wouldn't be a problem, but to Kelly. I saw Josh looking for me. It was only about 20 or 30 meters to the gangplank, and I was looking up at him and slowly shaking my head, getting some of the message across in advance. He knew exactly what was happening. He'd been there himself. I went up the gangplank, pretty certain I would be in the shit, and no doubt starting to look suitably guilty. This was the first occasion Kelly and I had had any decent time together since she'd been in the UK. It was like a newlywed leaving his honeymoon to go back to the office. As I got on deck, she and a few other kids were helping to clear up the plates under the bosun's instructions. For a horrible second or two, I had a flashback of her in her house just before her family were killed, laying the table for her mother in the kitchen. It made me feel even more guilty, but I told myself we'd both get over it. She would be upset, but I could make it up to her when I came back. Besides, she'd seen Josh and the kids, and we'd had a whale of a time. She'd understand. Plus, she could see her grandparents now. Josh knew what was on the cards. He bent down to his kids.
"Yo!"
He clapped his hands together as they waited for the instruction.
"Okay, kids, let's get all these plates back to the bosun."
And he dragged them away. I said, "Kelly?"
"Hmm?"
She didn't look up, just carried on being too busy picking up plates. She wasn't going to make it easy for me to give her the news. "That was my boss on the phone. He wants me to go away." She still didn't look me in the eye as she put the plates in a bin. She said,
"Why?"
"They've got a job for me. I told them that I was going to be with you for the week and I didn't want to go in, but they said I must. There's nothing I can do." I was kind of hoping she'd buy the line that they were to blame, not me. She stopped what she was doing and spun round. Her face told me everything I didn't need to know.
"Nick, you promised."
"I know, I can't help it. I've just been bleeped."
"No,"
she stopped me.
"It's beeped."
She was always giving me a bollocking for getting it wrong. Her face had gone bright red. Tears were starting to well up in her eyes.
"Listen, Kelly, we can always do this again some other time. Just think, Josh and his children have to leave a home in a few days and won't have a chance to see all these places, but we can come back."
"But you said... You promised me, Nick. You said you wanted to have a holiday with me."
The words tumbled out, punctuated by angry gasps for air.
You said you'd make up for not seeing me on my birthday. You promised me then, Nick. You promised.
She didn't just have her hand on my heartstrings. She'd braided them into ropes for extra purchase and was pulling on them big time. I said, I know I did, but that was last time. This time it will be different. I really mean it. Her bottom lip was starting to go and her eyes were leaking down her face.
But Nick, you promised.
I stroked her hair. I'm sorry. I can't help it. I've got to go to work.
Oh, come on, Kelly. Cheer up.
What the fuck was I saying? I always hated this. I didn't know what to do or say. And to make things worse, I reckoned I was starting to sound like my Auntie Pauline. The cry had become heart-rending sobs.
But I don't want you to go. I want to stay here and be a sailor. I want you to stay here. I don't want to sleep on this boat without you.
Ah, I said. And the way I said it was sufficiently ominous to make her look up.
You won't be sleeping on the ship. I'm going to take you to see Granny and Grandad. Listen, I promise, I really do promise. I'll make this up to you.
She stared at me long and hard, then slowly shook her head from side to side, deeply wounded. She'd been sold down the river, and she knew it. I wondered if she'd ever trust me again. There was nothing I could say because, actually, she was right. Just to make sure I avoided the issue, I walked across to the bosun. "We've got to go," I said. "Family problem." He nodded. "Who gives a fuck? He just gets paid to wear the hat and growl." Josh came back. His kids were halfway through a lesson on how to hoist the sails. I said, "We've got to go, mate." I tried to pat Kelly's head, but she flinched away from my hand. I said, "Do you want to go downstairs and change? You can say goodbye in a minute. Go on, off you go." As she disappeared, I looked at Josh and shrugged. "What can I say? I've got to go to work." And then, before he had the chance to come up with all sorts of different ways that he could help, I said, "I'm going to take her down to her grandmother's now. Then I'm off. I'm really sorry about this, mate."
"Hey, chill. It doesn't matter. These things happen. It was just really good to see you."
He was right. It had been really good to see him, too.
"Same here. Have a good flight back. I'll give you a call as soon as I finish this job, and we'll come to you next time." "Like I told you, the beds are always made up. The coffee, white and flat, is always hot."
It took me a moment to understand the white and flat bit.
"Is that some kind of airborne saying?"
"Kinda." I said goodbye to his kids, and they got back to pulling ropes and getting bollocked by the bosun. Then I went down below and changed. Chapter 2. We stopped at a pedestrian crossing to let a blue-haired, new-age guy saunter across. I laughed.
"Kelly, look at that bloke there. Isn't he weird?"
He had big lumps of metal sticking out of his nose, lips, eyebrows, all sorts.
I said, "I bet he wouldn't dare walk past a magnet factory."
I laughed at my own joke. She didn't, possibly because it was so bad.
"You shouldn't make personal remarks like that," she said. "Anyway, I bet he's been to the bloody tower."
Her schoolwork might be suffering a bit, but she was still as sharp as her old man. I looked across at her in the passenger seat and felt yet another pang of guilt. She was reading about how wonderful London was from a flyer we had in our hire car. She was sulking away, probably wondering what could be so important in my life that instead of taking her to see the crown jewels, I was dumping her back with her dreary old grandparents, who she already saw enough of during the weekends out from her boarding school. We drove through Docklands in the east end of London, past the outrageously tall office block on Canary Wharf, then, as we followed signs for the Blackwall Tunnel, The Millennium Dome, still under construction, came into view across the Thames. Trying anything to lighten the mood, I said,